Hi Ved, what's up? It's been quite a while since we've spoken.
It has. The lockdown temporarily opened, but we're back to square one.
Yeah.
I was thinking like what we can discuss this time, but I ended up realizing I haven't been able to follow much of the news, especially US elections. I was kind of hoping you can fill me in on that because we used to discuss it so much earlier, politics and the likes, but I haven't been able to follow it. So what's the latest?
Well, the latest is that things are going west, as it were, because I'm sure you've heard that Kanye West has declared his campaign, and he calls it his birthday party, which is ludicrous, man. Like, I don't even know what to say. And I thought that he might have already sort of unofficially withdrawn from the race because he needs to get himself registered in time in certain states. So I think he has a deadline today to register in South Carolina and get about 10,000 signatures. And it might so well be that by the time this episode actually goes out to our listeners, he's already dropped out. But it's quite ludicrous what's going on. And I listened to his speech, cum rap, cum whatever it was that he gave to people in Carolina, where he was talking about the fact that he's glad that his parents did not abort him. Apparently his father wanted to abort him, and he has these ambivalent views about abortion. He has ambivalent views about everything, and it's ridiculous. I mean, it shows to the extent to which populism has become a central feature of democracy today, that literally anybody can go out there and say whatever they want and get some amount of traction. I mean, of course Trump is the epitome of that, but even with Kanye West now we are seeing that.
Yeah, it's so this is a trend, right? Like the Kanye West thing, of course, is ridiculous. Like, this is the first time I'm hearing of it. The last thing I heard was the happy birthday party a few days ago. But yes, I think populism is in general a trend, right? It's not now. I think it's been there for a long time. You see the way in which our political marketing has changed over the years is around the world. So let's take US only, right? The way an Obama or a Bush used to market themselves. Bush corely on stuff like foreign policy, Obama corely on stuff like healthcare and education for children, and he used to talk of biblical values and things like that. And how Trump has gone absolutely corporate about it. And of course, like, it's almost ludicrous to say everyone's made this observation over and over again, but you must say it, that the way he's done his segmentation, he approaches only a core voter bank, which like Fox ruined for him now. But the way he does it, in the sense that it doesn't come across, it comes across as callous to an extent, right? And I think populism has grown to a level where it's been made clinical and no longer careful because people no longer caring, sorry, because people no longer care about whether they're appealing to the right sentiments or whether what they're saying is in line with what is politically correct. And it's not like they're following a trend, right? They're creating a trend. With a very core marketing team, they're going ahead and creating a trend. Like Trump has created opinion leadership through all the entertainment, the biz, and the stuff he's done, and covered up stuff like how much of a failure he is as a businessman. And all of this is a result of marketing. So yeah, populism has always been there, right? It's a historic, it's a human trait. But
I
we've
think,
changed it.
yeah. Yes, I think what's important to understand is why are we seeing this particular brand of populism that we are seeing today, right? I mean, you're right in the sense that populism has been there for a long time because leaders have always tried to speak out to their core bases and try and reduce politics to simplistic narratives. But why is it that we are seeing the kind of ethnocentric populism where there is a certain prioritization given to matters like immigration, matters like religion, matters like the kind of democratic discourse that we have, the value of institutions in democracy? Why is that? That is, I think, primarily because of two factors. One is the movement against globalization and sort of identifying an elite as being behind globalization and as being behind the financial crisis of 2007, 2008. And there is some merit to this because if you look at how, in the wake of the crisis, the big banks were all bailed out. But your ordinary American, your ordinary Brit, in some certain cases, your ordinary Indian as well, did not receive any kind of backing from the government, right? And all those big officials who were essentially responsible for the crisis of 2008, none of them faced any repercussions. So what has essentially happened is that a narrative has been fostered among democracies that those in power don't really care about the common man, which has allowed the likes of Trump to rise to where he has. by creating this illusion that he does care for the common man, in spite of the fact that he is anything but common in terms of his pedigree, in terms of the wealth that he has, in terms of his privileges. And the second thing, I think, apart from this movement against globalization, is the fact that we now have social media, which allows politicians to break down the barrier of the fourth estate, which is the organized media, to reach out to the public, right? So today, a Donald Trump can go on Twitter, can announce policies at 3 a.m. in the morning, and suddenly change the political discourse. And he does not have to do that with any degree of sophistication, with any degree of discipline, or with any degree of, let's say, restraint that a Barack Obama or a Bush would have to do, right? So political communication is now reduced to banter, is now reduced to the kind of pop talk that you would get.
Mm-hmm. No, so all of, I completely agree with that. But so look at how 2008 happens, right? And I'll tell you why all of these are linked together with a very common trait, which politicians have been trying to, I think, master for ages, right? Which is a very effective segmentation of who you're appealing to. And they've done it now through literally all kinds of progress which we've made in data science, in sociology. They've linked it together, they've put it together, and they've come up with far more effective targeted campaigns, right? And just quickly mentioning how globalization helps them. I think when the 2008 falls happened, right, one by one, and their Federal Reserve was confused whether to bail out or not bail out, and Bush took some tremendously stupid decisions. The assumption which these people make is that the trickle down is going to happen, right? One, which is exactly where people started getting disenfranchised. Because all the thought was that if I save American International, or if I save Lehman, or if I save Bear Stearns, somehow ordinary taxpayers are going to benefit, right? Which is what they kept doing. And on the other hand, social media is like the cover-up mechanism. Because on that front, people like Trump still keep doing the same things, right? They're still like, politicians, I think, across the world are still very much like Bush. They will bail out the elite because it is the elite that keep you in power, right? If notice, if Twitter does not, like the feud just started, if Twitter does not put out his tweet, there's literally nothing he can do about it. He can shout and scream. But if he's on his way out, and if the capitalists go against him, the IT giants, there's nothing he can do. So the elite are still being protected. Social media is being used as a way to show people that that's not what's happening. And the more effective their use of social media gets, the more effective their positioning is. So what Trump has done is that he's understood that white, bigot, male class, older male, like without college degree male class across the US is his core voter base, right?
Yeah.
And you notice what Biden is doing now. He's trying to pick a woman presidential candidate who's from Wisconsin or who's from Arizona.
Vice president.
So someone who's who's just a strategy, right? Who's just a clinical strategy. There's hardly any talk about the policies or the things which these VPs bring with them. When they're talking about Elizabeth Warren or Michelle Obama, whoever he's going to pick, right? The talk is about whether they're from a swing state or not. So, but that didn't happen. Like with Biden, that wasn't happening. It was, the talk was about Biden when he was the VP candidate with Obama. They were talking about how like he's had two failed presidential bid runs and all that. So like our talk has changed. We've somewhere, as people reading and consuming news also, we've normalized the idea that this will happen. That the clinical way in which politicians approach us is good enough because look, that's the norm.
Yeah. I think what has happened is we have allowed, and by we, I mean sort of the left liberal intelligentsia, and I think both of us, we're not sort of categorizing ourselves as left liberal, but what I'm saying is the left liberal intelligentsia that forms so much of the groups we occupy, even like in our friend circles, in sort of social media, whatever. The point is we have allowed the left liberal intelligentsia that license wherein it has gone ahead and created a gulf in discourse, right? You look at what's happened in terms of academic discourse, where there are very few right-wing intellectuals across the board, whether it's India, whether it's US, whether it's UK. You look at the way they have monopolized the discussions around identity politics on social media, right? What all of this has done is that it has disenfranchised a lot of the voices that does not subscribe to this worldview that the left liberal intelligentsia decides to portray, which has then allowed people like Trump and people like Boris Johnson to come in and cash in on those voters. And also because politicians like Hillary Clinton made the mistake of completely discounting this base that initially supported the likes of Trump, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember Hillary Clinton saying in what perhaps is her most egregious mistake during campaigning in 2016, mm-hmm. when she called the Trump supporters deplorables, right? And essentially, she ensured that that base was never going to engage with her. So that's been a huge problem. I mean, we talk about the rise of the conservative right. We talk about, or in fact, not even the conservative right. We have almost the rise of the right that is devoid of any ideology. I mean, what exactly is Donald Trump's political ideology that identifies along the conventional lines of left or right political thought? There is nothing along those lines, right? Even for that matter, with Boris Johnson in the UK, you don't see much of that. So they have essentially become ideologically mobile. And as a result of that, what has happened is, you suddenly see a form of discourse that has no long-term vision, that is mostly centered around winning elections. Same with Boris Johnson, same with Donald Trump and other places as well. And a kind of politics where people at one level are getting disillusioned, but at the same time are getting further polarized. So the gap between the left and right is far greater now in America, in the UK, in India than it has perhaps ever been, or at least in this century.
Yeah, so firstly, I don't subscribe to the idea at all of a left or a right. I think that these are constructed labels and all they do is like confuse the ordinary person, right? So in your and my head, it's easy to know what we mean by left and right, right? When people say, or like the first time someone came and said alt-right in a debate, very many years back, I was completely thrown off. And some of people expect you to know so many things and have so many connotations attached to left and right. Mm. But I think that is where the dilution process begins. Mm. Because there are labels. You must know these labels and you must know what these labels stand for. And to make matters worse, you must have, you must fit the people in public life into one of these labels. And then there are like subcategories, which really confuses people because say someone's got a policy that's neither here nor there, but is good for you, right? Like he's got a school bus policy. Like Biden's got a school bus policy, which I think was fair, right? But I can't categorize it as left or right, right? And there are so many politicians across the board, like Tejasvi Surya and all, who I don't know whether they're left or right or where they stand because, and the branding confuses me because I don't see Tejasvi Surya as a core BJP politician, but he's one of the BJP's strengths down south. So you really don't know whether these labels are helping you or not. So, and second is, I think the polarization, of course, with the labeling has happened largely because that's how they want their marketing to be. Like, it's easier to focus on one group of people, like Modi did, like Boris Johnson. Right? He focuses on that one target group of like Brexit supporters. And so you realize he's come to power playing the Brexit card. And he's just like his claim to fame, of course he's been a journalist and all, but is that he was Brexit's most ardent, most vocal supporter. And the way these people tap into one issue, one people and one community is absolutely fascinating because that is a core marketing move. And I think that polarization is happening because it's easy for them to delineate, homogenize, and then capture votes. And whether we like it or not, it is it's a two-way process. When like, even though we are feeding into the bubble, in some cases we create that bubble. Right? So I think in place like many of our like friend groups, you're creating that bubble when you are saying that this policy that just came up in the headlines today, when you're sitting in the pub and talking about it and fitting it into a label, it's you creating that bubble. But when the politicians are sitting down with their Amit Shahs and their psychologists and they are homogenizing and categorizing, that is when that's when like they actually want that polarization to happen. And they're hunting for characteristics which they can latch on to. So I think this is a process that's going to continue. It's just getting more nuanced as like more technology and more data is available to our politicians.
Yes. And I think one thing that you mentioned, which is very important, is that this sort of muddling of what is left, what is right, whether the right has anything left, whether the left has anything right, all of this is fairly confusing. And if you put it in the Indian context, it's actually not applicable because in India, the political movement has never really been divided along the lines of liberal, conservative, or capitalist, socialist. It's largely been along religious lines. That's what the freedom movement was for. And even after that, you've had the Congress as sort of the bastion of secularism, and the other parties like the Mahasabha and the Muslim League in Pakistan standing for more sectarian ideologies. So it's very difficult to actually create the left-right divide in India, because if you look at the BJP, politically they are right, but economically they are left. And there have been times in the Congress when the Congress, for that matter, has been economically more right of center. And in terms of culturally, of course, they've tried to at least maintain a garb of tolerance and embracing all ideas. But what I would like to sort of move this discussion towards is the second sort of consolidatory factor behind populism, which I believe is the cult of personality. And this is something that we were discussing last week, of course, at great length about Modi and Indira Gandhi. But what about the other populist leaders, right? The fact that they create certain impressions about themselves, about their characters, that essentially propels them in the popular imagination. And I think a very peculiar example of this is Boris Johnson. Now, the reason I say the word peculiar is because Boris Johnson, for large parts of his campaign, while he was running for prime minister, or even when Theresa May was the prime minister and, you know, he had political ambitions, the impression about Boris Johnson is that, you know, he's kind of a goofy, gregarious character. You remember when we met him, right? I mean,
I was going to say exactly that. He is a goofy character. You remember what he was talking about when we met him? He was talking about liquor trade in India.
Exactly. And he was talking about whiskey and sort of getting in greater whiskey from Scotland to India, and you know, lowering the tariffs. I found it very amusing. But like, even when we met him in that British Council conference, when was it? January 2017? Yes.
January 2017.
Yes. So he was the foreign secretary at that point in time. I had very, very little idea that he would ever become prime minister. If anybody told me that, I would have laughed it off back then, right?
I would have laughed it. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So why is so why is it that these people whose perceptions don't put them into the political mainstream are actually getting elected to office, right? I think that's very important to understand this phenomenon of personality cult. And Boris Johnson by no means is a Trump. I mean, a lot of people have heard, you know, comparing the two of them because like they are both white and blonde and overweight and whatever, hate immigrants. But that's not really the case. Boris Johnson is somebody who actually understands political discourse, but who has transformed his way of communication to suit the new populist wave. You know, who's kind of dumbed himself down in several ways. You look at his interviews when he was the mayor of London, and he's probably been the most high-profile mayor of London in a very long time. You go back, you read his columns. Yes, there will be the elements of bigotry, but there is also a great amount of intellectual discussion and intellectual rigor in whatever he's saying. But you look at his prime ministerial campaign, and since he's been prime minister, his communication has been dumbed down drastically to kind of suit the Tory and the conservative base, which does not want those hi-fi, high-falutin language that a Tony Blair had, or even to a certain extent a David Cameron had. So
exactly, which
No, just to finish. Just to finish the point that I think we really need to understand the personality cult, how these personalities are being built, that is actually empowering populism.
This is what a Corbyn does, though. So, which is exactly why he could, like, Jeremy Corbyn could last. So, comes back to the same idea. Like, this Boris Johnson point ties back to what you said about how in India that the people don't get the left and right. Like, the voter, the larger section of the vote base doesn't care about all this. But, yes, it's true that these people are appealing to they're making themselves into a consumer, like a demanded commodity more than a supplied commodity. What I mean by that is the consumerist king idea has floated down to politics also. Of course, the idealization, it still exists, but people are realizing that it's very easy to get opinion leadership, especially people like Boris Johnson, right? Who through Brexit got opinion leadership of so many of the segments in and around the UK. And through that, then he can push his policies through. Because people love him for something completely different from what he's talking about. When he talks about foreign policy, or if he talks about, say, the economy today, that's not what people loved him for and voted him into power for. When Modi talks about the economy and GST, that's not what Gujarat and Rajasthan voted him in for. Right? they vote the people in for a very different reason. And that's because they're banking on the consumer, that is their the voter base, being myopic, which is perhaps where we can begin to make like a small wake-up change. Right? We need to stop being myopic. Like, they get their way on a certain policy on which the leader concurs with us. And that's also not because it's their policy. It's because they've tailor-made it that way to suit what the majority is thinking about. So they follow the populist trend. They tap into it. They go into the heart of it, which is what Cameron couldn't do, right? He was like very, from a marketing point of view, his Brexit campaign, while it was happening, was being criticized for being very marketing foolish. That he was riding against a wave, right? If, like, think of it, if he's a prime minister, he's in power, he doesn't want the referendum to happen. That's the biggest talking point in the country. And he's being forced to make the referendum happen. There's enough sign anyway that, look, there's something wrong with the way he's appealing to the voter, because the people who elected him are no longer in majority because his opinion leadership is waning. And once their opinion leadership is in, these people go back to whatever policies they initially conceived of, right? Which is exactly why a second term of Modi is bringing in 370 and all the controversial things, and not the first term. Because people wait to get their marketing right. And now that he knows the Hindi heartland is going to vote for him, he's going to switch back to his policies, right? And this, like, interesting note, I don't think, like, so that's also a media thing, right? There are so many dumb voters out there who, like, of course, like, many people, right? It feeds into you. It's top of the mind recall. Like, it's a marketing flaw. If you're looking at two things which appear alike and you're made to think their connotations are alike, you're bound to believe that. Till Boris Johnson came into the limelight with his orange golden hair, Milo Yiannopoulos, if I get his name correct, he was being seen as the UK counterpart of Trump because he was a bigot. He had controversial opinions. He was annoying the life out of the left. And as soon as this happened, the face and the overweight and like the ability to visually make the two appear similar, the media latched onto it. Right? Or like people latched onto it, right? And the top of the mind recall kicked in. So when you're looking at a Boris, you relate to a Trump. And when you're looking at a Trump, you relate to a Boris. And the reference point is a dilution of how politics should actually happen. Because that's not what representative democracy is. Right? You don't look at people and think of the closest thing connotation you think of. You think of their policies. Mm. But that's what's happening. Because we're using our tools, like the front pages, to put a Trump and a Boris side by side on the first page and make people think again and again because you're drilling that into their head.
Mm. Yes, I think that's fair. I think Yiannopoulos is perhaps an outlier because, I mean, and also he was never sort of going to run for political office. But I get your point in the sense that this false equivalence that people create between Trump and Boris, and for that matter, this whole coterie of strong-arm leaders. So you have Trump, you have Boris, you have Modi, you have Netanyahu, you have Orban, you also have the Brazilian Bolsonaro. So you have all these strong-arm leaders who have been projected by the media as to have some sort of common ground in terms of the kind of politics that they are creating. And what that does is that it takes away from the different contexts in which each of them is governing, right? And it takes away from the fact that their parties, in terms of their ideologies, are very, very disparate. But I think the general trend and the trend that really needs to sort of provoke all of us into at least a concern is the fact that today the personality trumps, no pun intended, today the personality trumps the politics, right? It trumps the manifestos. Like, nobody even cares to read. Like, I was following very closely the discussion last year for the general elections here in the UK. And it was amazing how there was so little discourse on the Conservative manifesto for Boris Johnson's party. They literally did not match up to Labour in terms of either depth or in terms of the magnitude of their manifesto. Their only policy line was get Brexit done. Like, everything culminated to getting Brexit done. And that was enough for them to win, right? You look at even the Congress manifesto for 2019. They had a couple of decent ideas. For example, Nyay or the Nunatamo I Yojana, which is basically the Congress's take on UBI for a certain section of the population. that hardly got any mention whatsoever, in spite of the fact that that was probably the most constructive policy move that was
from actually, the Congress.
From the Congress. I mean, in terms of like...
Let's out say, of policy moves from the Congress, it was the most constructive.
Yes, yes. But the fact that it got, barely got any traction shows that, you know, the Congress's marketing mechanism, as you said, just does not match up with the BJP's and is not sort of updated for the kind of democracy we are in. So yeah, I think these are major concerns. The fact that we are not having discourse on real politics, but more on real politic, as it were, you know, and that is sort of leading to fractures. But there's another element I want to highlight, and this has become more pronounced in light of COVID, is to contrast these sort of buccaneering populist males that we just mentioned, the likes of Modi, Trump, and Boris, and all of that. We now seem to be having another small coterie that's developing, at least in terms of the wider imagination, of female leaders. So the likes of Jacinda Ardern and those leaders in Scandinavia. A lot of them have been elected very young to office. Even Angela Merkel. And the idea is that, you know, that these women are more benevolent. These women are more sympathetic. They are better at management and organization. And to a certain extent, they have proven that. I mean, for example, people like Jacinda Ardern have done a stellar job for New Zealand. But do you somehow think that this is leading to greater polarization? The fact that we are now viewing leadership as split, not only along the lines of ideology or personality, but also along the lines of sex and in the ways in which these leaders tend to interact with their masses.
No, it's not a new thing. So this is nothing, like, there's nothing new. Like so how it comes about, of course, it's a very immature-ish analysis, is that the talk about gender rights and the delineation along male and female and sexuality has become far more prominent. That discourse has shot up. But the discourse over, or like the hunting for things to delineate people over, is very common. Like what we did with caste and income, and like the things which we've made divisions within politicians over, right? The race card and the caste, like things which politicians have typically been playing into, is now moving, expanding itself to the gender bracket. Because like now look, like the male and female, the idea of gender equality has also become a talking point. If you put up a female candidate in a conservative area in India, it's still suicide. If you put up a female candidate in an urban area in India where the talk is about gender equality, it's a great card to play, because that voter base sees itself as a progressive voter base and you're appealing to them. It's like playing into a new caste altogether. Because look, it's the same thing. Again, you found a homogeneous thought process. You're putting a candidate who fits into that homogeneous thought process, makes people feel good about voting for them. So that polarization will exist. I think polarization along lines of gender, yes, is happening for the first time, right? Or at least is happening in a big way, with talk of people like Jacinda Ardern spreading globally and coming to an Indian who never read about it before. That's happening for the first time. But the idea of polarization is very old, right? And I think we should be open to the idea that as time progresses, the contemporary, whatever is that time's contemporary idea of division or the delineation being talked about, whether it's caste or gender, is going to be what the polarization is going to be about. Because same thing, like you said, they go back to what the consumer is talking about. If people are talking about gender, they're going to make it, the political party is going to make it about gender. If we start talking about caste again in the 2034 elections, it's going to be about caste again. So that's a demand-driven thing. Like what the people talk about, they make it. But also very interesting thing you spoke about, Congress. Right? I think the Congress is the ultimate failure of political marketing, because at least out of the political forces I know, look at Rahul Gandhi, right? That's literally where we begin the contrast with what marketing could have made you into. Because in Narendra Modi, if you look at him in 2001 or 5 or even 10 and 11, right before he won the 2012 elections, is not the kind of Modi which people will vote for across Rajasthan, Madhya Pradesh, Bengal, and Assam, and down south, and the kind of votes he's getting. And Rahul Gandhi right now is Modi before he transformed. Of course, there are many differences. He's got like a typical failure to connect with people in the language, about the culture, about the stories, and about the issues which they want to hear about. And something very simple, right? of course it's propaganda, but the video of, like, mentions the fact. There's a video out there of him talking in South India. I don't remember where. And he has a translator next to him. And he makes one statement. This is a rally, by the way. Right? And he's making one statement. There are thousands of people. And the translator is going to translate. And it's a very, of course, it's blown out of proportion, out of context. But the translator's stumbling every second. He's going towards Gandhi and asking him, like, what did he just say? Rahul Gandhi is repeating it. And everyone's having a moment, right? Having a great laugh. And it's unimaginable. And you're sitting watching that video and thinking of how embarrassing it must be for the leader there. Right? So this is a terrible failure of political marketing. You're making it so evident that the guy on the mic does not know your language. And you're even helping people make a mockery out of you. Yeah. To a point where Rahul Gandhi, like, stops in the middle and asks someone backstage to please change the translator. Yeah. Right? And it just fails to connect. Like, the words they use and, like, the policies they talk about just fails to connect. And that's kind of what Modi got over. Right down to the way in which he trims his beard, which is important, right? The visualization is extremely important down in the rural areas. Right up to the way, like, the way he plays the foreign policy card and walks down to Ladakh the second day. It's all important. It's a part of the evolution of what your product is. And he's a product. Like, politicians are products.
Yes. And I think on the Congress, what at least I have been seeing for the last several months is that this gross reluctance to come out of their bubble to address the fact that there is a problem. And not to communicate, as you said, in the language of the masses, right? So recently, Rahul Gandhi started this video series where he talks about different issues. So he spoke about China and, you know, why he felt it was opportune for China to attack India at the time it did. But you look at, again, the kind of audience this video is tailored for. It's primarily tailored for an urbane English-speaking audience. And Rahul Gandhi in the video himself just speaks in English. So it's not really going to help him because this is not going to eat away into the prime core voters of the BJP. And the people that Rahul Gandhi is speaking to are in many ways already aware of whatever he's saying. So he's kind of preaching to the converted because the urbane, middle-class, English-educated people in India don't really support the BJP. They are not their core base. So again, it's complete strategic miscalculation on part of the Congress. If you want to get Rahul Gandhi to speak on these issues, at least let him speak in Hindi. Because he's not helping his impression by engaging in English and, you know, sort of entrenching the idea that he's privileged, that he's elite and all of that suit boot kaneta, which he actually used for Modi once, also fits in very appropriately or would be fitted into very appropriately by the mainstream media upon Gandhi in this case. So, yeah, I think that the Congress has lost all sense of political market management, which is so essential now, whichever party you are across the board. Right. So I think
this is a very quick point was that Rahul Gandhi is essentially a leader for the urban English speaking class. Right? He's a leader for people like you and me. He resonates very well with ideas that a growing youth population would have. Of course, he's pushing 50, but it's like he's still a leader for the more urban class. I think his views are fairly modern. They're fairly clinical. But the mistake they make is trying to sell high heels to the Afghanistan government, Afghanistan army, right? You don't do that. It's an absolute product customer mismatch. He tries to speak in Hindi when he communicates excellently in English. And he can literally get elected himself from a place that wants to or can vote for him because he will find appeal within some sections and then get into parliament and do his thing and gradually spread. Because that's the idea. You sell to the first area, like the area closest to you first. Right? If there's a college in front of you and you're a canteen, you sell to that college and then start going to the other localities. But he doesn't do that. Yeah. And I think that's something which people like Boris Johnson and Jacinda Ardern and Trump have captured. Right? Where to sell yourself.
Yes. I think for the Congress to resuscitate itself and for Indian democracy to resuscitate itself, you need to look at the cleavages that the BJP has left. I mean, it's not left a lot, but it has left a few in terms of the fabric of Indian democracy. One of those cleavages is essentially the urban population, right? Today, you go to the metropolitan cities, you speak to the youth, especially people of our age group, right? 20s, 30s, a large number of them are disillusioned with the BJP. You look at their Twitter comments, Facebook, everything. That is one section to properly exploit. What Rahul is trying to do is that he's not getting this section completely on his side. He's sort of prevaricating as to what exactly his target base is. And in the end, he's neither eroding the BJP's core base, nor is he making decisive headroads into what can be his core base in the time to come. So, yeah, I mean, it's a strategic mismanagement. But, yeah, as we wrap up, one thing that I would like to sort of steer this back into is the larger idea of populism and where do you see this going forward, right? So we obviously have the 2020 elections in the US where there is a very good chance that Biden will win and an even better chance that Donald Trump in that case will not accept the loss, which he also mentioned in his Fox interview recently. I mean, that is an explosive interview by Fox standards about Trump. But anyway, the idea that where do you see populism growing? How do you think we can actually return to a semblance of the environment where we had proper political discourse, even if it was, let's say, less democratic in the sense that maybe the participation of the masses was lesser in shaping the discourse, but it was still a more organized, coherent, educated form of discourse that actually involved political decisions rather than, you know, just the personalities and their own idiosyncrasies.
I think that's a tough call, right? Because, of course, it'll be an immature opinion, but I think the future of populism lies in the fact that there is more power as technology progresses and the polarization continues. Segments of the population refuse to talk to the others. The bubbles become stronger, and that really helps politicians. Because a stronger bubble means a stronger leader emerging out of the bubble. Like the more consolidated white, non-college degree, older vote bank is in the US, the stronger or Donald Trump gets in his mandate. So I think the future of populism lies in how well these bases get consolidated, how well we can make people look, how well they can make people, like our communities, look internal and like look inside and not outward, and where exactly we fit in, where we think we fit in terms of our identity, right? Like people like you and me who really think we can transcend the identity of a white male from Calcutta and move into so many different segments, right? Like I identify with four communities. So like linguistic communities off the top of my head. So, but the more we can get people of that, of course, not that we're an ideal, but the more we can get people who are willing to transcend these communities, the more difficult it is for populist leaders to let their populist campaigns run effectively, clinically, and targetedly. And the minute it stops running in a targeted fashion, we somewhere start countering populism, which is for populism's sake. So, like, just for the record, I don't think populism is bad, right?
I think
populism for populism's sake, and stuff like talking about the vice president being a woman because the woman card, and talking about her being from a state which is a swing state, because the swing state card is wrong.
Yes.
Because populism, as long as it doesn't dilute core politics, like you said, to become real politics, is absolutely fine.
Yes, and it's also inevitable. Populism in a democracy of the size that we see in most countries, right, is inevitable. But it's also about understanding, as you rightly said, that how do you bridge the gaps between the different fragments of the voter base? So, yeah. Great.
Oh, Kanye West just went and said in a rally, I think this was a few hours back, he went and said that Harriet Tubman never freed the slaves. She just had the slaves work for other white people.
Yes.
And people got up and left from the rally.
Yeah, man. But there were also people who were cheering him on for saying that on Twitter, perhaps in the rally as well. So again, that is a very sort of microcosmic example of how the populist bubbles work, right? So you can outrage one section of the people and at the same time be hailed by the other. So
Yes, there's a video here. He's having to quieten down a cheering audience. Yes.
Yeah. All right, then. I think on that note, we'll wrap up. And hopefully over the coming weeks, we'll get some idea as to how the populist discourse is potentially changing. Very important weeks, of course, with the lockdown relaxing in certain places and potentially being reinforced in others. And let's hope for the sake of greater democratic discourse that in due course, these populist discourses become more organized and at least regain some element of political currency that they have lost in the last 3-4 years.
I agree.
Okay then, chalo.
Cool, chalo, see you.
Bye.
Hi guys, thank you for listening to this episode of That's What We Said. Ved and I have been wanting to do an episode on populism for a very long time. It's one of those themes that is really relevant to the political discourse today. And I'm sure a lot of you have very strong opinions about this. So do let us know in the comment section what you think about populism, what you think about populists, be it in the West, in the Middle East, or even in India. Spotify is now the latest platform on which That's What We Said has made its debut. There are also other range of platforms that we will feature the podcast on, which we will let you know in due course. So please subscribe to our podcasts, give us feedback, and we'll be back soon with more episodes. Take care.